Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. What happens if the U.S. government can't pay its debts? Let's get to the bottom line. Have you ever been in a situation where you've maxed out your credit cards and desperately need more money, but you've got nowhere to turn? Well, I hope not, but that's exactly where the U.S. government may be right now. America has hit the ceiling legally mandated by Congress on how much it can borrow. The limit was set last year at $31.4 trillion, but the government already burnt through that by January. Now the two parties are gearing for a showdown to negotiate a new temporary limit by June. The Republicans who control the House are using the opportunity to demand major cuts and rollbacks to President Joe Biden's agenda, especially those related to clean energy and food assistance to poor Americans. The White House says, no way, just give us a new limit and then we'll talk. So who wins in this game of political brinksmanship? And is there really any limit to the runaway spending of the U.S. government? Today we're talking with Bobby Kogan, who worked in the Biden White House as an advisor to the Director of Office of Management and Budget. He's now the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. And Gordon Gray, who served as a staff member for the Senate Budget Committee and is currently the Director of Fiscal Policy at the American Action Forum. Let me just start out and say I figure that one of you is a Democrat, one of you is a Republican. We're not going to tell the audience which yet. But let me just start for a second with you, Bobby, and ask, you know, why is this such a big deal, this debate about debt limit? Can't the United States government just print more money, print its way out of this problem, and deal with this? What are the really the dynamics of this debate that many people are fearful could lead to the first serious default by the U.S. government?
Sure. And first, Steve, thank you so much for having me on. So we are one of only two countries in the world with a fixed dollar debt limit. A handful of countries in the world also, you know, have debt limits of another kind, you know, set as a percent of the economy. But we're one of the only two in this way. And ultimately what it is we, hearkening back hundreds of years, we used to have to issue each, Congress used to have to approve each issuance of debt in a law. And we changed that to set a dollar limit. Now, every so often, depending on kind of how much we've raised it and what our new deficits are, we have to keep increasing it again and again, lest we will default. And this is really a question of whether it is we want to actually default in our debt, which I think, you know, we'll all agree here would be catastrophic if we didn't pay our bills.
So you agree it would be catastrophic. And you work Center for American Progress. A lot of Democrats work at Center for American Progress. Do they take seriously debt and default?
So I think there's a robust debate about the net effects of debt on the economy. Most people will say that all else being equal, more debt as a percent of the economy might kind of have some sapping growths. Of course, and I can get to this later, all else is never equal. You have to figure out what it is you do to lower the debt and whether the net whether the effects of lowering the debt are worse or better than the effects of what you did to lower it. But I think most people agree that all else being equal, you'd want lower debt as a percent of GDP, especially during good times, and higher during bad times deliberately to kind of boost aggregate demand. The threat of default is, of course, really, really, really major. We might have had a technical glitch here or there before, but we have never deliberately defaulted in our debt. Because why would we? Why would we deliberately say, I know we promised we'd pay you this money, but we won't? That would be catastrophic. No one would trust the U.S. government's word. It would send interest rates skyrocketing. Obviously, it would cripple the economy and take and destroy many jobs. And then, in addition to that, we wouldn't make our payments, and that would hurt all the people who rely on those payments, whether they're government contractors or Social Security recipients or disabled veterans or the people who we help put food on their table. Or, you know, you name it. The government does a lot of things.
Gordon, we had a debt level, mandated debt level in 2002. Of $6.4 trillion. Today, it's $31.4 trillion. How did that little number become so big?
Well, a couple things there, Wolf. First of all, one of the challenges in using nominal numbers is that we allow, you know, decades of inflation just kind of send those up anyway. But unfortunately, over that last 20 years, we've had global wars, a once in 100-year pandemic. We've had the Great Recession. We've had somewhat calamitous events confront this country, and we are privileged to live in a country that has the wherewithal to respond robustly. And it's actually interesting as we think about the current debate right now, which is it used to be that Congress had to pass a law to issue basically a single issuance of debt. It was
right.
So rare. But obviously the federal budget has changed substantially, and now the debt limit acts as a limit. It used to basically be an allowance so that they didn't have to pass individual laws, but we've gotten somewhat addicted to deficit spending and the growth of indebtedness that dynamic has flipped entirely.
Why isn't there more discussion about a defense budget that's approaching $1 trillion? That seems to be sacrosanct for some reason, even in both parties. Whereas you've got a debate on what kinds of cuts you have to put in place to either protect Social Security and Medicare, or you have some Republicans who actually want to cut Social Security and Medicare in order to keep those trust funds solvent. So unpack it for us.
Sure. So a part of the issue behind all of this is that over 70% of every non-interest dollar we spend goes directly to people. That's in the form of stuff like Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid and SNAP. It's also in the form of, you know, kind of direct payments to help people afford their groceries help people afford their groceries or help with childcare. So that's kind of over 70%. And the remaining bit is sort of it's research, it's investment in the future, it's transportation infrastructure, and it's the military. And so part of the issue behind all of this is that what the government's doing is quite popular. And so figuring out what you would cut, first of all, it's probably unpopular to do it. And second of all, it might have deleterious effects to do it, because most of what we're doing is kind of directly helping people in the moment or investing in the future. As for why it is that the military budget is kind of largely untouched and the rest of it is kind of always on the chopping block, that's an issue of politics. The military spending as a percent of GDP has declined significantly in the 20th century, but of course there are two big reasons.
So again, it's a big dollar amount.
It's a big dollar account, but it's been declining. There are kind of two reasons there. One, you know, we used to be engaged in massive wars all the time, and now while we obviously are always engaged overseas,
right.
The full kind of breadth of the way we are is significantly down. And the second one is that the U.S. is significantly bigger than every other country. So if the U.S. spends 3% of its GDP, I think it's a little bit more, but it spends 3-ish% of its GDP on the military, that is a lot more than another country. You see the stats that the U.S. spends more, you know, around as much as the next 10 countries combined. We're not spending 10 times as much as percent of GDP. It's that we're a big country, and so we know we can do a lot.
Gordon, tell us where the state of play is right now. You know, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has put out a plan.
Yep.
And the plan says, let's keep Social Security and Medicare solvent where they are. But he's saying to get the debt ceiling increase that we want, we've got to have cuts in other areas. The Democrats and President Biden has responded very, very strongly against Speaker McCarthy. How, you know, what's your take on that state of play?
I think the legislation that the speaker put together is very much an opening bid. Essentially, the White House and congressional Democrats pointed their fingers at Kevin McCarthy, says, you know, put up or shut up. Now, this week is where the rubber meets the road, and it's now on him to find the votes for this proposal.
Let me just stop you there. For Kevin McCarthy to find the votes for his own proposal, right?
Sure.
Might he not have? He's the Speaker of the House.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a majority in the House. Might he not have the votes for his own proposal?
It is possible that he doesn't have the votes. His majority is sufficiently slim, and his majority is populated with a number of members who are not wildly inclined to support anything that a leader puts out. And one element of the debt limit historically is that there are always members, Republicans and Democrats, that are intransigent on this issue. And they essentially say, I cannot vote for this, or I will not vote for this. Sometimes those are a little different. One is the cannot is my constituency will eat me alive and I will not get reelected.
Does anybody remember that President Joe Biden did not vote for a debt limit increase in 2002 when George W. Bush was president?
Nor did. And
how do they explain that?
The former, the last Democratic president, President Obama, also voted against the debt limit under George W. Bush, and the rationale was rhetorically very similar to what intransigence on the other side say.
So high-handedness about, you know, the full faith and credit of the United States, you know, facing potential collapse. they risked that before. So does it undermine their credibility today, Bobby, when talking to Republicans and saying, don't put the U.S. government at risk?
Yeah, I think you can absolutely call hypocrisy on individual members. You see that all throughout. At the end of the day, politicians are politicians, and they want to make the points they want to make. I think my frame would be, in terms of the bipartisanship of what, you know, clean increases to the debt limit, we had 7 clean ones under President Bush, and those were all large. They were all very bipartisan. It's true you have plenty of Democratic members who did not vote for them, and you had some Republicans who didn't, but those were very bipartisan increases. And there were 3 under President Trump, and those were also very bipartisan increases. Kevin McCarthy voted for all 3 of them. When we got to the Democratic presidents, all of a sudden, they were a lot less bipartisan. I think that's kind of the point that I would make. It's true, you can find individual members, you can call hypocrisy, right. You're not wrong to do it, but there's a big difference here that when it comes to be a Democratic right. president, you get to see stuff where they say, I mean, Democrats didn't say, for instance, under President Trump, we will only consider, our opening bid is for you to, I don't know, do Medicare for all and raise the minimum wage. You know, they didn't say, this is our opening bid. They did a bipartisan increase, and I'm sure you had individual members who might have pushed, but I think there's kind of a kind difference going on here.
It doesn't take an incisive political scientist to look at governance in the United mm-hmm. States as being divisive and fraught. And when you sort of roll that into a scenario where if Congress cannot pass an increase in the debt limit, well, now you have a reason to fundamentally doubt that proposition that the Treasury is a riskless security. It forms the basis, the bedrock, the benchmark for global financial markets. Banks are capitalized in it. They underpin.
So, Bobby, what happens to regular citizens out there? And yeah. What happened? I mean, like, what are the? I hear this is going to be a tsunami of chaos. What is that? What's happening to regular people?
So just to the extent that the treasuries are the bedrock of the financial system, every financial transaction that a private citizen is engaged in becomes costlier. Hmm. And so that is your mortgage, your auto loan, everything with an interest rate, everything that interacts with the financial markets, and people will understand just how interrelated all these are because everything in their life will become more expensive. On top of that, you will have disruptions to the federal government. And so that that can involve, they will have to basically husband the cash that they have that they should be using to pay other bills. And that can have consequences now for the broader macroeconomy. That can have consequences for employment. And so all of these are layered on top of an economic outlook where, you know, nobody's out there saying, oh, we're heading for boom times. People are talking about the risk of recession. So we're adding this on top of, I think, existing anxiety about the economy for every American and probably a lot of people around
so
the world.
So it would suck.
Yes, sir.
It would be a terrible thing.
And I would just say, to go on top of it, so Gordon did a great job of laying out like all the ways in which the financial sector starts to collapse if we default. Mm. In addition to that, the government is forced to immensely pull back on its spending, right? So you're no longer allowed to run a net deficit. And if deficits, I don't actually have off the top of my head what the projected deficit this year is, but if it were to be $1 trillion, then that would be $1 trillion of less spending into the economy. And right. since, as I said, the hypermajority of what we do goes directly to individuals, that means there's 70% less of that that's going directly to individuals. And so that means everyone's paycheck, everyone's wallet is lower. You can afford less food to put on the table. You can afford less childcare. All the things that we do to make everything be interacted, that's not happening. Your Social Security checks are down.
There's a book coming out in June that I've looked at called The Paradox of Debt by Richard Vague. And Vague makes the point that as debt has increased in the United States, government debt, household savings has gone up. But he says what's very, very disconcerting is the inequality gap. That those folks with assets tend to gather much more assets. And as that debt rises, the federal government debt, the private gains of the most wealthy in society are there. So I'd just be interested in that side because Joe Biden has come out and said part of this is we need to pump up the IRS and we need to tax the rich more and deal with these social contract stresses. Is there any resonance for that within regard of talking about the debt ceiling politics? And is there any room for that to run?
Yeah, that's actually a great point. I looked at this in 2019 when I was working at the Senate Budget Committee. And the net assets of the United of the nation are significantly up, even netting out the debt that the government holds. Right, so the assets net of the government's debt are going up and up and up and up and up. I think they're up to 136, 137 trillion as of the last.
But wouldn't it argue that like increasing debt's a good thing?
Well, so whether or not it's a good thing, what's very clear is that the line that you hear. That we are leaving the next generation worse and worse off. That's just not true. People are getting richer and richer and richer on a real per capita basis. The issue, as you said, is that where the accumulation of wealth is really bad. You have some people who are doing extremely well, and you have a lot of people who are falling behind. Mm. And that's, you know, that's where we really ought to be focused. And I guess that would be my retort to the idea of we can't possibly afford to raise our debt limit because. You know, we're over leveraged. We're not.
Gordon?
So I would not be someone who would argue that we can't afford to raise a debt limit. Rather, I would argue that we have to raise a debt limit. And when we are going to consider doing so, we should also consider the budgetary context in which we're doing it. Now, the proposal that the Speaker McCarthy put forward, I don't think anyone's under any illusion that that piece of legislation is going to be signed into law. I don't think that the Senate's going to pass it. I don't think that the President of the United States right now is breaking out his pen to sign it into law either. And so to the extent that a negotiation ensues and we increase the debt limit and there's a negotiated a budgetary component to that, it's going to be fairly small ball.
Right.
You know, we're going to run $20 trillion in deficits over the next next 10 years. We're going to spend $80 billion. And the high, you know, the legislation.
Billion
Kevin,
or trillion?
Trillion.
Trillion.
Excuse
okay,
me.
Billion, yeah.
billion here, a billion there.
Okay.
But the legislation that Kevin McCarthy put forward may reduce spending by $4.5 trillion over the next 10 years.
Let me ask you a question. Why do they go after climate change and food stamps and say military spending is great? It's really not just about fiscal conservatism. If you are saying, okay, so I'm just sort of interested in the targets they're going after
sure.
in this debate.
And the reason they have each Republicans and Democrats, particularly over the last 6 years, have all agreed that the most significant parts of the federal budget, so that is the major entitlement programs and the tax code, are off limits. And once you've walled off all but 10 to 20% of the federal budget, then no matter what, when you are only negotiating on a small sliver of the federal budget, you're not touching any element of the real budgetary risk that we're facing. So I actually think in this debate that we're seeing here is that there's a lot of risk that we talked about not increasing the debt limit. And I think the upside budgetarily is fairly small. And so I do think it is worthwhile to have this conversation, recognize where in this current environment is. There's some compromise on the budget, but also recognize that we're still have a lot of work to go. And this probably is not the debate where we're going to tackle the budget problem.
Is it crazy to have this debate at all? I mean, when you kind of look at the fact that they're only going to, if they succeed and they go with Kevin McCarthy or the Joe Biden plan, we're talking about a $1.5 trillion increase to this 31.4. So that would get us up, you know, about a $1.5 trillion more leeway in the government debt that can be carried. What does it buy them? Is this just assure another nightmarish, gladiatorial contest in this right before the election?
Yeah, I mean, one quick response, and I wanted to get to something else. You actually, he said $1.5 trillion or March 2024,
right,
whichever comes first. So that is showing that even if it got him longer, then we still want to set it up to have a fight right before. But getting to your first point, what about this in the first place? What I would say is I think that the debt limit should be completely separate from, whether we default is just a separate question from what our fiscal path should be. I mentioned in the beginning that most countries don't do it the way that we do. And that's because they know that if you want to change your deficits and if you want to change your debt, you change your spending and tax laws.
Right.
You don't say, well, we should think about this or else we'll default. Right? Like, that's not an okay position. So Congress can and should debate its fiscal path, but they shouldn't do it with the pretext of, if this doesn't work out right, then we might default in our obligations. Like, that's not an appropriate way to do it. And I would just say, we also do have a debate about fiscal policy every single year, right? Speaker McCarthy focused the hypermajority of what he was focused on.
It was like blackmail. You know, kind of. You know?
Your words, not mine.
but it raises the interesting, and also the deal that Kevin McCarthy did to be in government. You actually have statements of some of the GOP members that supported Kevin. There were holdouts and then came on board. They've been out saying, we want to wreck the federal government budget process. We want to wreck. We want to see government fail. So I just want to have people know that while that may not be the bulk of views, it's certainly become part of the equation. You disagree?
I think I would just want to at least note that at the end of the day, to increase the debt limit, you need to have a bill pass the House and the Senate, and the president has to sign it. Right now, there simply aren't the votes for a clean debt limit. There aren't the votes for it in the Senate, and there aren't the votes for it in the House.
Right.
Now, I understand why that would be frustrating and inconvenient, but individual elected legislators have to be the ones who take this vote. And right now, a clean debt limit does not have enough votes to pass the House and the Senate. And
so real quick, your gut answer, your prediction, are they going to pass this, your view?
I think they will increase the debt limit. I think they will increase it. I don't think they're going to pass the speaker's legislation.
So you're an optimist that a deal will get done?
A little bit.
Bobby, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I'm bad at these predictions. I think the risk of default is the highest it's been in U.S. history.
I agree with that.
Internally, I was around 50-50, which is a coward's number, right?
An economist.
Yeah, right. 33.
Yeah,
that's right. Some, you know, whether you're at 25, 50, as Gordon said, if you take people at their face, at what they've said, their statements at face value, then there aren't the votes. We might find that when we're really close to it, we could have like a TARP-style situation where we're right there, and then we find that there are the votes. I would say the only reason that there might not be the votes is that some people have decided that debt is inappropriate now that Biden is president, when it was appropriate before. Again, there was huge bipartisan support.
Republicans have spent a big chunk of that debt.
And to go to this, I put out a report a month ago that said it's not about the level of debt, it's about the trajectory of debt, but it just said if you hadn't done the Bush tax cuts, their bipartisan extensions, and the Trump tax cuts, then debt would be declining forever as a percent of GDP.
Fascinating conversation. I wish we had more time, which I rarely say in a talk about debt and debt limits. Bobby Kogan, Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress, and Gordon Gray, Director of Fiscal Policy at the American Action Forum. Thank you so much for a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Steve. Nice to be here.
So what's the bottom line? Here's the paradox. Growing the national debt can actually help grow the economy, and it can increase the private sector's wealth, even as the government's debt burden gets heavier. But too much debt can drive up inflation, it can make the dollar lose value, and it can undermine confidence in the future. No one has a magic wand and knows how to balance America's budget, no matter what the country's leaders say. So yes, America will keep printing money. As for the politicians, though, the debate on the debt ceiling is going to go to the brink. I think we're probably going to be okay. Still, there's always a chance that someone may misstep, misjudge, or misfire. And then things can go downhill really, really fast. And that's the bottom line.